Most of you who are present this morning have come with me through a long series of sermons on the life of Christ to the last few days of his life, spent by day in the holy city of Jerusalem and by night in a little village in the suburbs where he had friends who made him welcome. I've been reading the different gospel accounts very carefully in recent weeks. And even though I know the danger of bogging down in tiny details, I'm going to run that risk for just a few minutes at the beginning of this sermon. I do it because I keep thinking that if intelligent church members knew what ministerial candidates learn in the great non-denominational seminaries, we would have far fewer literalists and far more skillful readers of the complex book we call the Bible. So I am going to digress almost before I start this morning and ask you to pay attention to a very odd thing that happens in our text. Trivial at first glance, very exciting, I think, if you are truly curious about how the Bible was put together. Mark, the earliest of all the gospel writers, has Jesus say to his disciples, "Go into a nearby village where you will find a colt and borrow it." They are obedient. They find the colt, bring it back, toss their coats over its back, and their quixotic friend goes riding into town on this meek creature. Luke tells this story exactly the same way Mark does. One animal to be found, one animal brought back, one animal ridden into the city. But when you turn to Matthew's version, the story changes and problems pop up. We know that Matthew had a copy of Mark in front of him, which he followed as he wrote. But at this point, as he sometimes does, he deliberately departs from the Markan script and alters the story. He has Jesus say, "Go into the village where you will find a donkey tied up and her colt with her. Untie them and bring them to me." Now we have two animals instead of one. And this is going to lead to an awkward moment later in Matthew's text. The disciples go ahead and do what Matthew's Jesus has told them to do. They bring the donkey and the colt, and then, and I'm quoting verbatim, "they laid their cloaks on their backs, and he sat on them." This is what Matthew's Greek literally says. He sat on them. Well, it's pretty tough to sit on two donkeys at once. And why would you want to? It's such an awkward sentence that translators into English cheat a little bit in order to gloss over the problem. So the Revised Standard Version of Matthew says, "They brought the ass and the colt and put their garments on them, and he sat thereon." On both? Or on one? Aware of Matthew's odd little predicament, They just chose to make it vague. Today's English version, very popular, says they brought the donkey and the colt and threw their cloaks over them, and Jesus got on. Ambiguity again to disguise a puzzling and awkward moment in the text. Now, if you are committed to literalism, you might become ingenious and say, well, maybe he rode first on one and then on the other. That isn't very logical, but it doesn't take much logic to comfort us when we have taken an inflexible position. But then, of course, if you are committed to literalism, you would still have a problem with this story. Mark has one animal. Matthew has two of them. Which one is correct? Which one do we read literally? Literalism simply won't work in this place. So what's the answer? And will finding the answer make us any wiser when it comes to knowing how to read the Bible? Well, I'm convinced that it will, or I would not risk putting you to sleep like this. We can solve this puzzle by remembering, and you'll need to listen more closely now than ever, that Matthew is the gospel writer who is forever connecting Jesus to the old Hebrew prophecies about the coming of their Messiah. Matthew knows a verse in Zechariah that speaks in poetry, underline, in poetry, about how a gentle Jewish Messiah arrives in Jerusalem and, quote, rides on a donkey, first line, and on a colt, the foal of a donkey, second line of poetry. But Zechariah is actually describing one animal, not two. He's using a figure of speech called hindiadys, in which two words connected by a conjunction are used to express a single idea. You express one by means of two. Clear as mud? Okay. Let's provide an example from the second psalm, because this is a very common thing in Hebrew poetry. Here's a line. Here are a pair of lines. They go in couplets. Why do the nations conspire? First line. And the peoples plot in vain? Second line. Those are not two groups. They are one group. Those are not two different ideas. They are simply two different ways of saying the same idea. The nations and the peoples are exactly the same. What we have is poetic repetition. Same trick in the next two lines. The kings of the earth set themselves, first line, and the rulers take counsel together, second line, not two groups, just a way of saying the same thing twice. Students of Hebrew poetry call it synonymous parallelism, which you can forget before lunch if you like, but which is what got Matthew into trouble. Zechariah was saying that the Jewish Messiah would ride into Jerusalem on a donkey, comma, on a colt, the offspring of a donkey, one animal. Luke and Mark have no problem with that. Matthew misunderstood it. His literal-mindedness got him into trouble, and he has Jesus appear to straddle two animals instead of riding sensibly into town on one. When we discover how frequent such problems are, we are saved from foolish and dogmatic statements about what the Bible is like. It deserves the most careful and honest scholarship we can bring to it. Otherwise, we distort how it was written and how it means. But take heart, the mini lecture is over, and I really do intend to speak of the Passover supper, which Jesus ate with his disciples in the upper room. The menu: roasted lamb, unleavened bread, not a loaf to slice the way we do, but a small flat cake of bread broken by hand and dipped into a sauce of dates, raisins, and vinegar. A cup of wine, blessed and drunk, a chunk of bread, a second cup of wine, and a verse from one of the old Jewish songs, and along with the wine, a little sip of salt water to remember the tears shed by their ancestors in bondage in Egypt. And on this particular night, a sense of impending disaster. One can almost hear the disciples asking one another, "Why is he so sad? How would anyone dare arrest a man so popular with the crowds?" And then the unexpected thing, said quietly and with deep regret, one of you is going to betray me. Each one asked, "Am I the one? Who is it?" Even the one who went by the name of Judas. At some point during that long evening meal, Jesus lifted up one of the round little cakes of bread, broke it reflectively, and said words that means something like this in English: "This broken loaf represents my own body. Whenever you do this again in the future, think of me." I agree with those who believe that he probably did not intend the establishment of a ritual which we now call the Lord's Supper. He was never much for ritual. It seems more likely that he was only saying to them that when this great Passover festival was celebrated each year, they might recall the friend they had and what he had hoped and how he had wished so much that the kingdom of love would rule in our hearts. But when he was gone, and a new religion was born, and when it began to organize itself in ways I think he could hardly have imagined, his followers found a way to make that supper into a Christian ceremony and to celebrate it in new ways and at new times, until for most people it became hard to remember the simplicity with which it had all begun. I hope no one will be offended if I say that there is a quite different version of what happened that evening, which grips my imagination more powerfully than any of the other things I have described. Of the four Gospels, only John tells this story, and curiously, he never says a single word about the bread and the wine. Here is John's version of what happened that night. Jesus had said to his disciples, "I have yearned with all my heart to eat this meal with you. Not just because it might be the last time, but even more because they still so desperately needed to learn something basic if his kingdom of love is to have any chance at all. Something is wrong in that room with his closest friends. They are thinking, even on this night, about who will get to be president and vice president in the coming kingdom. In light of what Jesus does next, I think it's possible that they have trooped into this room like pouting school children, each one determined to see that none of the others get ahead of him. There is a basin and towel in the room for bathing the feet before they are lifted up on a couch for dinner. Perhaps on other occasions, they perform this simple courtesy for one another, since they have no slave to do it. But on this night, as I imagine it, they are not in the mood to bend down before someone else who might be a rival for honors in the coming kingdom. For that reason, or for one like it, Jesus realizes that they need a shocking lesson in the true nature of the kingdom of God. So he stands up suddenly, takes the basin and the towel, and begins one by one to bathe the feet of his incredulous friends. You can imagine how hot and miserable their faces must have gotten as he came to each in turn and knelt. But no one spoke until he got to Simon Peter, the one who was always so impulsive, so apt to blurt out whatever he had in his mind, who stared at this incredible sight and said words that meant, "What is this all about?" And got an answer back. "What I am doing, you do not understand now, but later on, you will." Peter was deeply embarrassed. "You're not going to wash my feet. I just won't have it." It may be his best moment in the whole gospel story. I know I like him better just then than at any other time. I like the vehemence with which he rejects any thought that he might merit such royal attention. But once again, gravely, Jesus says, "If I do not wash you, then you have no part in me." And the words suddenly go soaring up from the literal to the symbolic. "Something must happen to you tonight, Simon Peter, or the dreams we have dreamed together will end, and you will drift back to your boat on the lake and spend the rest of your days puzzling over what might have been and how it all went wrong." Put that now into language that will include you and me. If our fellowship with Christ, if the roads we walk with him, if our prayers and our religious ceremonies are not cleansing us from what is destructive, if we drift on from day to day, much as we have always done, quarreling with one another about places and preeminence, scheming to outwit one another to be sure of winning the prize for ourselves, then for us, too, the enterprise has failed. We have missed the point of the whole kingdom business, and we are not really His. Isn't it interesting how most of us in the Christian world copied the little drama of the bread and the wine, but let the foot washing drama slip quietly away and be lost, except as a quaint and curious moment in one of the Gospels? I'm not proposing we bring it back, although I would argue that anyone who claims the Bible must be read literally would be absolutely obliged to bring it back. But most literalists manage to overlook this commandment. It's so much easier, for one thing, to take communion, to crunch and sip while we sit politely in our pews, than it is to get down on our hands and knees with a Rubbermaid dishpan and a hand towel to reenact the lesson of that far-off evening that we are supposed to be servants to one another. Convenience affects theology more than you may have guessed. So we need not copy literally that foot-washing ceremony, we tell ourselves, although I hope we would not scoff at those who still do it. All the way from the hard-shell Baptist deacon to the supreme pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church. On Maundy, Thursday of next week, the Pope himself, in the Sistine Chapel, will kneel down in a moving ceremony to wash the feet of 12 poor men who symbolize the apostles. I know how easily a familiar ritual can turn into a meaningless form, but I think the sight of that would affect me the right way. Take me back to the night of the secret supper and teach me again the lesson Jesus tried to teach that night. Because you see, there is always the shell of pride about our hearts. And by some act of love that touches us as deeply as those disciples were touched that night, the shell has to be broken. So may there be, this morning or this week, such a moment for each one of us.